welcome back to the podcast, Hey, I Like, the podcast for all of the things that make our little neurodivergent brains go, wee! I am here hosting this episode. It's Tom from the Lotra and Tolkien episodes. And I'm back to host this one with special guest.
It's me!
Who is this time going to be talking about stuff? Yay!
Yeah, I'm really excited for this because we haven't done a double feature before, and this is sort of like a double feature thing. They link together.
Thematic.
The episodes link. How fantastic is that? So I am going to be talking about. It's down on the spreadsheet as Norse sagas. Whether it's like actually sagas is like debatable. I think it's going off in some weird directions, but like it's sort of sagas. We're calling it sagas. It's fine. But yeah, so the sagas link to Tolkien because Tolkien was inspired by the sagas and like the Anglo-Saxon stories and all that, like medieval literature and stuff, which is really cool. And that's sort of how I got into it, because I'd read The Lord of the Rings and was like, I have read somewhere that this came from the fact that he studied like medieval literature and languages. Maybe I should go and look at some of the source material. And picked up the Volsunga Saga, because my copy, my very, very first copy of the Volsunga Saga had a big sticker on it that said, inspired Lord of the Rings. Which it did. And I read that one and nothing else until, actually that's a lie, I did read some of the others, but like I didn't really take it seriously until I was doing my master's degree. And this is why I said that this episode is going to be saga related, but it's a little bit off in weird directions, because when I was doing my master's, one of the modules that I did was a translation in the long 19th century, which still doesn't really make sense to me, because a century is 100 years. All centuries are 100 years. 100 years is a long time, but why should the 19th century be any longer than any of the other centuries? It's still 100 years. Anyways, I was doing a translation module where we studied like weird Victorian people who went all over the world and found all these stories and translated them back into English. And some of them are better than others.
It is something that, if anyone who has watched Overly Sarcastic Productions will know, some of the mythological tales that they come from are like, this was recorded by a Victorian. We don't know how much it's actually like accurate to the area that it's recorded from, but there's like one or two like footnotes about where they got it. So maybe it's a real story from the area.
Oh my God. Do not get me started on the guy who was translating for our Japanese week. It was so bad. Anyway, there are some interesting translations from that time, and those were the only ones we were allowed to read. So that was fun. One of the ones that we didn't study at all was any of the Norse sagas or the Icelandic sagas, and I thought that was a very interesting choice considering how popular they were in the period. Like, this was when Wagner did the Ring cycle, and we'll get onto that a bit later because that drives me insane. But like, this is when the sagas had a sort of revival in popular culture, I guess, because the Victorians were really into Vikings for some reason. So they sort of had a bit of a revival. So I thought it was a bit strange that we didn't study it. But the nice thing about postgrad study is that you can write your own essay questions and you can write about basically whatever you like. So when we did our essay at the end of the module, I asked the professor, like, we can write about any translation from this era, right? Like, it's not just the ones that we studied. And he was like, yeah, sure. So I wrote my essay on translations of the sagas and how some of them are really shit. But yeah, the sagas in general are super cool. You're just gonna have to trust me on this one if you don't believe me already. Some people think they're really boring.
The Lord of the Rings episodes, you should know.
I know. Well, some
there's
people
a lot of faces on those.
Some people think they're really boring because the language isn't particularly like interesting. It's not particularly like flowery or like over the top or that kind of thing. It's very simple language. And a lot of, like, especially the Icelandic sagas are, like, their family sagas, so they detail, like, the, like, events and lives of different people in one family, and they follow them along for, like, centuries, which some people do find kind of boring, and it's like, okay, yeah, I get that. So you're just, if you're listening to this and you're just like, yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking, you're going to change your mind. Basically, you need to change your mind. Otherwise, we are going to have issues. Because, yeah, the Icelandic sagas in particular, which is the ones that I was reading about, they tell stories about real events and real people, which I think is really cool because they are the exact same words as people were telling each other hundreds of years ago, and they're about real things that happened and real people who actually lived in that period, which is cool. They're not quite nonfiction enough to be considered like historically accurate accounts that we can trust absolutely, because, you know, there's things like dragons in them and cursed objects and stuff like that, but they're pretty close. Like,
I mean, this is the thing with, if you do any level of history beyond like sort of 100 years ago, this happens a lot. I mean, so many of the Roman histories are filled with these.
Oh my god,
stories.
Yeah.
We still look at them as historical documents that tell us useful things.
Yeah, and it's like, I was reading, so I read the Volsunga saga, and then I read the Vinland sagas, which is the saga that tells about Leif Erikson sailing to Vinland, which is in North America. And they think they found the archaeological site. They found it in like the late 60s, I think, which is a whole other story that I could have focused this episode on, but I chose not to. I really want to go there. But anyway, they found this archaeological site that they think might have been like a Norse, like, winter camp, right? Which matches exactly with what is told in the Vinland sagas. And they found this partially by drawing a map based on stuff that is talked about in the saga. Like, they read the saga and they were like, well, they said they had like this sort of wind blowing them in this direction, and they sailed for this many days, and they said that the coast looked like this, and they found where Vinland was based on details in the saga. It's that, like, accurate that they went and they found the place that nobody thought was a real place, and then they dug it up and they found a camp there, and it's like, that's super cool, the fact that we can do that. And like the Laxdæla sagas and the Landnámabók book, they're like the stories of Iceland and the early period of Icelandic history and how Iceland was settled and how they developed their society and stuff. And Iceland's the world's Europe's oldest democracy. So like having those kinds of stories and them still existing now is pretty impressive, honestly.
I think there's a chance it's the world's oldest.
Well, I was told the world's oldest, but I'm also very aware of the fact that that could be very like Eurocentric, and there might have been things in Africa and Asia. I don't know. I was told world.
Other reasons, a lot of the other ongoing democracies in other countries happen to get destroyed at some point for
Yeah, Iceland got really, really lucky because they are considered Europe/the world's oldest democracy that's still in existence, but Iceland was a colony for centuries, so they are really lucky that they got to keep that. But yeah, so you've got like the Vinland sagas, the Laxdæla sagas, the Landnámabók, and they tell these real stories about real people and things that actually happened, and we've got other historical, like, not necessarily accounts, but like evidence, like archaeological evidence and stuff, that suggests that things happened pretty much exactly how it's written down, which is really cool for stories that weren't written down until like 300 years after they happened. You know, these stories were told entirely orally. until they were written down post-Christianization, which would have been like the 1500s, 1400s, 1500s. And they're stories about like the 1000s. So you're looking at least 300, 400 years later, and they're still exactly the same as they were then. And now we're in 2024. I very nearly said the wrong year. And they're still the same because, like, translation aside, they are still the same stories as they were 1,000 years ago, which is insane to me. I love that so much. I love history. Anyway, because they're stories about, like, real things that happened and real people, they're really, like, grounded in reality, you know? So, the gods that they believed in are mentioned. You might see references to like Seder or ritual magic or curses, but it's not like they said a magic word and pointed a stick and then there was a fire. It's more like we did a ritual to try and make the weather good and the next day it was sunny, so it must have worked. And it's like, it's not a sort of magic is definitely 100% real and impacts our lives and we are all wizards kind of story. It's this is what our religion says. Yeah, it's exactly the same way as like the Romans and the Greeks were writing stuff down and mentioning their gods, and like the Iliad and the Odyssey mentions all the gods doing stuff. It's sort of exactly like that. It's not this is definitely real and absolutely happened this way. It's like we believe in the gods and therefore the gods do these things. You will rarely see things like gods and dragons and mythical creatures as characters in the Icelandic sagas, because the Icelandic sagas are about real people. And from some research that I did, not for this episode, and not even for that essay, just random research that I did, the Norse sagas in general, when they were telling them about like kings and great battles and stuff, there's very little exaggeration in them because culturally it was seen as an insult to have to exaggerate what actually happened to make someone look good. So there wouldn't be much like, oh, the king was like fighting and he struck down like 1,000 brave warriors or whatever when he actually only killed 100 people, because the idea of having to exaggerate the numbers was something that was quite insulting to that king personally. Because it makes it sound like he wasn't good enough to do it, like to be glorious on his own, which is pretty cool. So you can sort of almost take things at face value. You can't quite, because you know they're still stories, but they're about real people and real events that happened, and culturally exaggeration was seen as a bad thing. So you can almost trust them. They're more historically accurate than a lot of stories told by people at the time, which, I don't know, I keep saying it's really cool, and it is really cool. That's the only word I can think of. But in terms of like the Volsunga saga, the one that inspired Lord of the Rings, that actually makes it kind of a weird one. Because that one does have magic that's a crucial part of the plot. And it does have the gods appearing like as characters. And it does have cursed rings and dragons and all sorts of stuff. But, and here we get into the weeds of weird saga things. The Volsunga saga is sort of kind of not really Icelandic. And if any Icelandic people are listening and are offended by that, I'm really sorry, but it's true. I did the research. So we will get on to that, I guess, because Volsunga saga is weird and I spent way too long researching this for a stupid essay. But yeah, so we're not going to talk about it a lot because the whole thing is fucking stupid. Oh my god. There are two versions of the story, right?
Mm-hmm. Carrier. What are the two versions?
There is the Volsunga saga, or the saga of the Volsungs, which scholars still say to this day that it is Icelandic. And then you have the Nibelungenlied, which is German or Germanic in origin. They are the same story. They tell exactly the same story about exactly the same people at exactly the same events. They are the same. Okay? Stay with me. One of them is German, and it's told in German. The other one is Norse, or Icelandic, and they exist simultaneously, and this is totally fine. Ignore anyone who says otherwise. The story is based on events that probably slash possibly actually happened in the area that is now Germany, sort of the time of like the Goths and the Huns and stuff. And there are two texts, in whatever form that takes, that evolved from oral traditions in both like areas. Because the thing to remember is that the Norse are from Scandinavia, so Denmark, Norway, Sweden, and into Iceland. Denmark and Germany are neighbours. So there's a lot of like stories that originated in that region more broadly and sort of dribbled over into each individual country. But because country borders are stupid and did not exist until quite recently. And things like two countries having the exact same story and both claiming that it belongs to them is something that happens quite a lot when you have countries or cultures that are neighbours and the country borders got drawn like less than 100 years ago. So please don't ask me who this story belongs to. I will cry. It doesn't matter. This was the whole point of my essay. It's stupid. What matters is that it exists and the story of the Volsungs is the story that inspired the Lord of the Rings. It has a cursed ring. It has a quest. It has so much family drama. It's insane. I regularly say to people that my own family drama is very similar just because we have also have stupid inheritance disputes. It's stupid. I hate it. But yeah, so the Nibelungenlied is the German version. Wagner based his on both, I think, or possibly the German version. The Volsunga saga is Norse, but most people just say it's Icelandic. It's... I don't know how it got to Iceland, is the thing. Because, I mean, I do know how it got to Iceland, because Iceland was settled by Norse people anyway, and they would have had the story. But it means it didn't originate in Iceland. It originated in the Norse, like, homelands in mainland Scandinavia and would have just sort of gotten to Iceland by boat, I guess, via the settlers. But the reason why people say that the Volsunga saga is Icelandic is because of William fucking Morris. I hate this man so much. Oh my god. So William Morris wrote the translation of the Volsunga saga that I had to write about for my essay. Because he wrote that translation with Erik Magnusson in like the 90s, but I don't think it was the 1890s. It was in the Victorian era. It was in the 1800s. William Morris is the guy who did a load of like art, pottery, fabric stuff. For some reason, he also went and did a load of translations of things. I don't know why he cared enough to do that. He did a translation of the Volsunga saga. He also did a lot of translations of various German myths and German tales. William Morris had a problem with sources, which for anyone who is in academia of any kind knows is a little bit more of a problem now than it probably was back then, but it's still a pretty massive fucking problem. Use sources, cite your sources. Oh my god, I hate this man. So he claimed that his translation of the Volsunga saga was a direct translation from the Old Norse from the via like Icelandic. He claimed that he translated it directly from the Icelandic. His version of the saga is written in prose, which is a problem, because the Volsunga saga was first written in the poetic Edda, which is not prose. And that was the point at which I was like, I am going to murder this man who is already dead. He cannot have written a direct translation of something that was written in poetic form when his translation is prose. That's impossible. He would have had to have changed quite a lot. And he did. Do you want to hear some of the things that he changed?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, dear. Okay, so his whole agenda was basically to say that all of the sagas are Icelandic, which is a bit of an odd idea anyway, which for reasons that we'll get onto in like just a second. But because of that agenda, he changed all of the spellings of the names to be Icelandic spellings of names. He changed the setting of the Volsunga saga to Iceland. And remember, this is a story about real events that actually happened in what is now Germany. So you're reading this saga and you've suddenly got mentions of like the Huns in Iceland, which did not happen because Iceland hadn't been settled yet. So it makes it just completely historically inaccurate, which is not the point of the sagas. The point of the sagas is that they're telling their own history of stuff that actually happened in the places where they said they happened. Because remember, the Vinland saga, they went and found Vinland based on the saga. You couldn't do that with his translation of the Volsunga saga because he just changed the setting to Iceland, which doesn't work because the landscape is completely different. It's like, have you been to this country, William Morris? And apparently he had. There's one copy of the Volsunga saga, like written down, that existed at the time when he would have been translating it. It was not in Iceland. It was in, I think, a university in Norway. He never went to Norway. He did go to Iceland. I don't know where he got this from. I don't know where he got this saga from, because it wasn't the written down version. He didn't translate it from anything unless someone told him the story and he wrote it down in Icelandic somehow when he didn't know the language. But yeah, it's not unusual for a Victorian English translator to change things about a story to fit an agenda. But he changed, like, a lot of stuff. All of his sentences are really, really wordy. Which is interesting because the sagas are meant to be very simple language that's easy, because these are oral stories that have been told for several hundred years, like with no changes, which means they need to be easy to remember. And he made them all so wordy that I don't think I can remember any of the sentences off by heart. I was having to check between documents like 15 million times while quoting things. But yeah, it's like you're changing so much that it's basically like a different, like it's the same story, but it's no longer like a translation. It's a retelling. But yeah, he was so bad at citing his sources and telling people where he'd gotten things from that he got letters, multiple letters, from different German scholars asking for sources for other works because they'd never heard of them. German scholars asking for sources for German, like translations of German stories, because the Germans had never heard the stories before, and he just never gave them. And it's just like, I have so many questions about whether he even had sources for any of the things that he claimed to be translating, because if he did, I can't find them, which is a pretty big problem when you're writing like essays about translations of things, because you need to know where someone got the original from. Like, it's really hard to judge how good a translation is when you only know the language that they are translating into, it's even harder when you don't have an original to compare it to. So that sucked. I hate William Morris for many reasons. The lack of sources and the fact that he changed things is most of it, but yeah, it's not great. Shall we talk about colonialism?
Yes, go ahead.
Because that is next. Colonialism was the whole point of everything in this period, because England was trying to, you know, do their British Empire thing and expand their empire to literally everywhere. And so was most of Europe. William Morris, when he published his translation of the Volsunga Saga, was claiming in the like introduction, it was him and someone else wrote like a foreword. There's like a foreword and an introduction, and both of them claim that all Norse sagas are Icelandic. Which is wrong. But it's very interesting. Because in this period, Iceland was a colony of Denmark. And it continued to be a colony of Denmark until 1946 or 48, I think. It was after World War II. So that was interesting, considering William Morris is also from England, which is the colonial powerhouse. But yeah, it's really odd. And before that, Iceland had been a colony of Norway. The reason why it was then a colony of Denmark is because Norway was a colony of Denmark. It's very... Scandinavian politics is really odd, and I don't really understand most of it. But they seem to be getting along all right, so... Sure. But also, can we... Oh, there we go. It was 1948. Just to say, a massive fuck you to Denmark, because they did not grant Iceland independence until 1948, which is earlier than England did for a lot of their colonies, but still pretty late. And they took Greenland in the divorce. Even though Iceland was the one who settled it. Which is just such a dick move. Like, come on, Denmark. Just let them have Greenland. Greenland should be its own country. Not gonna lie. But, like, if Greenland had to belong to somebody, Iceland were the ones who colonized it in the first place. So Iceland should get it. But anyway, so 1948, Denmark granted Iceland its independence and took Greenland in the divorce. But to their credit, they did let Iceland go very peacefully. So Iceland held a referendum, and the Icelandic people said they wanted to leave, they wanted to be independent. And Denmark was like, sure, okay, fine. Which I'm 90% sure was because they had their own issues post-World War II that they needed to sort out. But, you know, whatever. That's better than the UK. So... Like, the UK murdered people over this, but yeah. So...
The UK also invaded Iceland during World War II.
Oh my god, they did, I know. The US had a military base there until, like, 2006?
In fairness, Iceland didn't, like, fight us on the invasion. It wasn't a proper invasion, They weren't super thrilled.
Iceland is a very strategic place to have a military outpost because it's midway across the Atlantic, sort of. It's between mainland Europe and the Americas. So countries like the UK and America really liked having military bases there because it was like a stop-off point. Mm-hmm. Especially during World War II, it was good.
Yeah, so when Denmark
could take their ships there and
to Germany, we didn't want to also lose Iceland, so we're like, yeah, we'll just look after Iceland.
Yeah,
we lost one person because they committed suicide.
Yeah,
that was our total option for taking over Iceland.
Yeah, and then America had their military base there, and the only reason why I know that is because I used to live there. But yeah, so. But yeah, so Denmark let them go, which is better than the UK did for like 90% of the UK's colonies. But the bar was on the floor. So...
the bar is so on the floor. The UK was much better at giving away its colonies independence than most of the empires were.
Yeah.
Which again is a pretty bad sign.
Yeah. But yeah, so Iceland had a really interesting, twisty relationship with the sagas as a cultural identity, specifically because they were colonized for so long. Because independence campaigners in the early 1900s were using the existence of the sagas to sort of prove a long-standing national identity that's separate from Danish and Norwegian identity, right? Because this is why I was saying earlier how some of the Icelandic sagas in particular, their family sagas, are really real. Whereas there's a sort of a split between the two styles of sagas, because there are Norwegian and Danish sagas that are still Norse, but they sort of take a little bit from the Germanic epics, I guess, where they've got things like the gods appearing and dragons are there and magic is there and stuff like that. Whereas the Icelandic sagas are very we are going to follow this one family for 200 years and every single generation of this family and see exactly what they do. And this guy got exiled, so we'll follow him around for 10 chapters and stuff like that. So the Icelandic sagas have a bit of a different style and a bit of a different focus point to the other styles of Norse saga, and they were using that to try and prove that they should be their own independent country, because we've got this heritage that is separate from the general sort of Scandinavian heritage. Yes, we have things that we share with you, but this thing is ours. We made this for ourselves. And the fact that they still existed and they've been written down and they've been translated and they were popular and stuff was sort of used to sort of prop up that sort of idea that they were separate and unique. Which means it's especially interesting that William Morris went around claiming that all the Norse sagas were Icelandic and that Iceland was super cool and whatever, because Denmark was very worried about these independence campaigners and how they were using the sagas. And England probably would have been quite worried about it as well, or at least the sort of colonial elite would have been quite worried about the fact that Iceland was going around saying, hey, we have these stories that are entirely unique from our colonial overlords' stories. That means that we should be our own country. That would be quite concerning, I think, for the people in charge of the empire. But no, it's most of the sagas that you read about the Norse or the Vikings, if they are dramatic, are not Icelandic. So the Icelandic sagas, you've got the things like the Laxdala saga and the Landnámabók and stuff like that. They're the Icelandic sagas, the family sagas, like Grettir the Wise and all of that, and the Vinland sagas. But things like the prose and the poetic Edda, however you say it, they're Norwegian. They were written by Snorri Sturluson, who was Norwegian. And he had an agenda of his own in trying to create this sort of cultural cohesion between all the Scandinavian countries. And he was writing those down post-Christianization, trying to say that, look, we have this cool cultural identity that links us all together, Norway, Denmark, Iceland, Sweden. And it also can fit neatly into our concept of good and evil based on Christians and Christianity and how that works. So there are these weird interlinking ideas and different people writing from different places and different times and saying, we've got the one version of the story. And it's well, they were oral stories. So realistically, there are probably quite a few different versions. But yeah, it's got a very strange, interesting, link with colonialism and all of that sort of thing, which I think a lot of people don't really realize because they think of Scandinavia as like, well, they're white. You know, they're white. They did the colonizing. They were colonized. And it's like, well, actually, some of them were. Like, if you look at the history of each individual Scandinavian country, like Iceland has been a colony for like 500 or 600 years. Denmark, Norway, and Sweden basically just kept switching between themselves who was the colonial superpower in the region. Like, it was Sweden for a bit, then it was Norway, then it was Denmark, then it was Norway, then it was Denmark again. And it's like, yeah, it's... they all did the colonizing. They were all colonized. It's a very interesting and slightly weird relationship with colonialism in that area. It's bizarre. Anyway, so that's colonialism. This is the background that you need to understand what is going on when we were talking earlier about how, like, who the story belongs to and how that whole idea is just really stupid because they all belong to everybody. And trying to say this one story belongs to this one place and nobody else is like, well, why? You know, it got to this place somehow, you know, and it was in their language when it got there. So either you translated it for them or, you know, they also managed to, through like cultural or linguistic drift, pick the whole thing up. And it's, yeah, the whole idea is stupid. It's all colonialism somehow.
Well, it's always interesting to see how those historical things impact the cultural stuff.
It is, yeah, because like so much of the stuff that we were looking at on that module was translations that had this really like overt colonial message because they were being translated into English by English people. Some of the translations were just like blatantly incorrect. Right, like we were reading, I think it was like the Rubaiyat, which is a sort of Arabic, I think, story. It's all poetry, and that translation was really, really bad. But it was like they have everyone who translates these things has an agenda. It's like when you read any of the English translations of stories from India or like, or Kipling or whatever, trying to write fairies, like not fairy stories, but like children's bedtime stories set in or about like India and the British Empire in that area. They're all really racist. They're all really colonialist or imperialist or whatever, but they all claim to be local stories. And it's like, are they? No, you've added that racism in. Because you're English. It's really bizarre. And then, of course, because history is written or told by the victors, that's the version that you know. I found it really interesting to study. Would hate for it to... like, I hate the fact that it happened, because colonialism, by and large, is a terrible thing. But it's really interesting to look at how things changed from where we are now looking back, I guess, and how it changed things historically and how it changed things culturally. It's horrifying to look at the effects on some countries now, but it's interesting to look at how it affects places. But yeah, so we're coming back to translations now, because all of the sagas that you read are translations. Translation is cool. I am fascinated by the concept of translation because it's really difficult and I can't do it. Iceland in general is really cool. They have not changed their language enough for it to be uniquely distinguishable from Old Norse. So what that basically means is that people from Iceland do not need translations of the sagas. They can read the original documents because the language has not changed enough in the last 500 years for it to be a new language. Like, if you think, if we read documents from like the 1500s. Like, there's entire translation documents for Shakespeare. That's the same language. You know, in Iceland, they don't need that. Because the language is so similar, all that's been added to it is, updates.
Isolation tends to make languages more similar, and Iceland has been fairly isolated. It's really interesting that Icelandic is more similar to old Norwegian than modern Norwegian is.
Yeah, it is. It's crazy. But yeah, they're so isolated that the language basically hasn't changed. And they have, like, actual laws about loan words from other languages. They would rather make a new Icelandic word for a thing than have a loan word come into the language. They're so, like, specific about what they're allowed to add to the language that even now it's still that similar to Old Norse. And that's not, like, there are ways in which that's a bad thing, but there's ways in which that's really cool as well, because it means that they don't need translations from old Icelandic into new Icelandic. It's the same language. But they're the same with things like their horses, right? You're not allowed to bring any horses onto Iceland. I can't believe I made this about horses again. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, you can't. If an Icelandic horse ever leaves, it can't return.
If an Icelandic horse leaves the island, it can never come back. You cannot bring another horse, whether it's Icelandic or not Icelandic, onto Iceland. They're so strict about that that you cannot bring. So, like, when we visited Iceland last, we were like, we'll go for a ride on an Icelandic horse, right? But then we read the guidance before we came, and it was like, you're not allowed to bring your own boots. You're not allowed to bring your own gloves. Your clothes, if you've worn them around horses, they need to be, like, deep cleaned before you're allowed to bring them into the country. And it's because they're so isolated that they're really concerned about illnesses from mainland Europe hopping over and, like, wiping out the whole all the horses.
In many ways, very similar to, I mean, a lot of islands have this. Australia is also very careful about what they let in.
Yeah.
And so are we. I mean, we don't have rabies.
Yeah. But yeah, this was, like, insane levels of, like, carefulness. Like, we did wear our boots because they were the only boots that we had. But it was, like, we had to, like, spray them with a hose and then polish them. And, like, they had to be spotless because they had to look new. Because if they had not been cleaned and, like, disinfected to that level, we would not have been allowed to bring them into the country. Because they were that concerned. And it's like, they're right to be concerned, because, like, look what happened when Europeans went to the Americas, right? And they brought smallpox with them. It wiped out all the people. Like, I know they did that on purpose, but, you know, like, even if they hadn't, it would have been catastrophic. So they're entirely right to do that. But it does, like, it's really odd to look at from the outside, where we're, like, crossing over with all these other countries all the time. They're like, not obsessed, but they have this really keen interest in keeping, like, their language and things that relate to their culture as, like, pure. Not in a bad way necessarily, but, like, we have to keep this separate from other languages to keep it to, like, as something special, which, like, if it was the UK, you'd be like, this is really racist. And it is kind of, but yeah, it's interesting. I like that their language hasn't changed that much in 500 years. I think that's particularly cool. Mm-hmm. Technically, they're all in the same language family as the Scandinavian languages, which is great for me personally, because it means that sometimes I'll read a quote in a, like, journal article or something, and I don't need a dictionary to translate it, which is nice. So, for example, there's a sort of phrase in the Volsunga saga that was brought up in an essay that I was reading. Bestu þær ekki batn, which is Icelandic. It's similar to Fæstna de ich borden, which is Danish for, like, fasten they not the boat, which doesn't make any sense in English, but, like, you can see the connect, especially when it's written down, you can see the word order is exactly the same and a lot of the like words look very similar. That was a particularly close example. If you wiggle the words around, because English is a Germanic language, and which takes a lot from Norse, you can wiggle the words around and very quickly you can get things like they fastened not the boat. They did not fasten the boat. And it doesn't sound very different from English. Like, fest would be very similar to like fastened or fast or fast. And like borden, borden, that's similar to boat. Yeah, so there's similarities between different languages, especially between Icelandic and the Nordic languages in some instances. In others, they're entirely separate, and you can really see how the mainland sort of Scandinavian languages have shifted over the years away from the Old Norse, but there are some instances where they still really cross over. But yeah, so I speak a little bit of Danish, not much, but from that, you sort of get that Danish doesn't really use auxiliary verbs, and neither does Icelandic, or they don't use the like periphrastic auxiliary verbs. So it's not like did not do or I am eating. It's not that version of the verb. So sometimes you sort of have to jump through these linguistic hoops to make things make sense. So Danish has like no difference between I read and I am reading. It's the same verb. So sometimes, yeah, you have to sort of twist things around to make them make sense in English, which is fine. We can do that. But it was something that William Morris and Erik Magnusson got into a lot of arguments about, because another reason to hate William Morris. Erik Magnusson, who helped him with the translation and who was an Icelander, wrote about William Morris after he died and like how they worked together to make these translations. And I'm pretty sure what did he say? I can't remember the exact words, but it's basically like William Morris had come to him and basically said, I don't care about the grammar. The grammar doesn't matter. I don't care. I just want a good story, which is like, that is an entirely valid interpretation of translation. You are allowed to do that. But please, if you do that, say that that is what you are doing. Don't pretend that it's an entirely accurate, direct translation of something. If you have actually just told your language expert, fuck it, I don't care about the grammar. I don't care about the translation. Just make it sound like a good story. Because that's what he was claiming. He was claiming that it was a direct, like, word-for-word translation of the Volsunga saga. And that that was why it sounded really archaic. It sounded really weird in places. Like, some of the sentences didn't really make sense. It was really, like, hard to read, like, aloud. And he was basically saying, well, that's because it's a word-for-word translation. Right? Like, it's not going to make entirely make sense because I've just translated it directly from Icelandic and changed nothing about it. And it's like, well, A, that's not true, because if you did, none of it would make sense. And B, we have anecdotal evidence that suggests you told your grammar expert to not care about the grammar anymore. So yeah, it's a whole thing. So I have several different translations of the Volsunga saga specifically, one of which is the William Morris translation, which I despise. I also have two identical copies. I don't know why I have two copies, but I have two identical copies. There's a translation done in the 1990s by Jesse Bjork. And that's a pretty good translation. That translation uses the German spelling. So for context, one of the characters is called Brunhild or Brunhilde. The 1990s copy uses the German spelling of Brunhild, which is like Brunhild. The 1880s translation, so the William Morris translation, uses the Nordic spelling, I'm assuming it's a Nordic spelling. It looks like how you'd spell it in like Danish or Icelandic. It's still pronounced Brunhild, but it replaces the U with a Y, because in Danish a Y sounds like a U. So it's just interesting that you've got these little tiny differences. And I think that sometimes the differences are so that it makes more sense to an English reader, which you know, works, because if you read the Danish spelling or the Nordic spelling, not knowing how to read Nordic languages, you would absolutely assume that it said Brynhild, because we use a Y to make a different sound. So using the German spelling makes sense in that context. But yeah, it's like translation is really like slippery and hard to get hold of, which is why I find it really interesting. This is sort of an episode about translation rather than the sagas. So
it has definitely become a more generalized episode.
Well, I haven't read the saga in a while, so I can't remember like everything that happens. Otherwise, I would just be telling the story again if I did that. So we'll talk about translation instead. But we can talk about Tolkien. So as we've said several times, this is the story that inspired Lord of the Rings, because Tolkien was an expert in this stuff. What I did figure out is that most likely he would have been reading the Morris translation, because that would have been approximately the right period.
Oh my god, I'm definitely going to have to do more research into what translation Tolkien read, because that is so funny to me if it was.
Well, I worked under the assumption that it would have been the Morris translation, because that was published in the 1880s and there weren't really very many other translations until later on.
The only thing is, of course, that Tolkien himself, I don't know exactly all the languages that Tolkien knew, but there would be a reasonable chance that Tolkien could translate it himself.
Yeah, exactly.
Based on my knowledge of Tolkien. So there may be an unknown Tolkien translation, which maybe he...
That would be amazing.
There was an unknown chance that he read the William Morris translation, went, this is awful, and made his own.
Like, Christopher Tolkien, please find your...
Christopher's dead!
Oh, yeah, he is, isn't it? Who's the other guy? Who's the one he's been publishing all the stuff recently?
Well, I think those were still edited under Christopher Tolkien's editorship.
I was going to say, I'm sure I've seen his name on them.
Yeah, no, because he was the main editor and has always been the one who's been in charge. I don't know in the Tolkien family if there's anyone taking the same level of control as Christopher took. Because Christopher obviously just had so much more access to these things. Christopher was much more involved in these things. Not to turn this into a Tolkien episode, but...
I mean, you know, it sort of is. Whoever is in charge of the Tolkien estate, can you please find Tolkien's translation of the Volsunga saga? Because I would love to read that.
I would love to. It would have been... Because obviously, like, Tolkien's inspired by a lot of different sources. One, like, fairy tales in general. But there's definitely... I mean, one thing I'm sure we've talked about before is quite a lot of just the names in, especially for the dwarves, are just
Norse names from the sagas.
Gandalf as well, like,
yeah. But yeah, it's like the Morris translation would have been approximately the right period for Tolkien to have been reading it as a child or a young adult.
Whenever I worry about the fact that my D&D world has a lot of names of places and things stolen essentially from Lord of the Rings and the Silmarillion, I'm like, on the other hand,
Tolkien stole them, so...
Can't have a go at me for this.
Yeah.
Original character, Gandalf.
Yeah. But the Morris translation specifically is, it's full of poems and songs which are taken from the Poetic Edda, which is the original Norse text. So, having read The Lord of the Rings and The Silmarillion and The Hobbit, which are also full of poems and songs.
He does love that.
You see that he took something from the experience, which is a positive thing, because he did not write something that is basically the Morris translation, because the Morris translation sucks. But he took something positive from it and put it into his own work, which is exactly what you expect.
There's a translation of Lord of the Rings that was so bad that Tolkien himself got upset and retranslated it for that work.
I love that so much for him. But yeah, so this is the saga of the cursed ring. This is the saga Fafnir the dragon appears in. So you can see that's the Hobbit. that's Smaug the dragon, basically. Because Fafnir was originally, I can't remember if he's human or a dwarf. I think he was human. And he had the ring, you know? And which obviously is where it differs, but he hoarded all of this gold and like jewels and riches. And the more he hoarded, the less human he became until he turned into a dragon, which is a really weird thing to read. And yeah, this is one of the reasons why reading it, I was like, this is different from the other Icelandic sagas. I don't think this is very Icelandic. It makes total sense that it originally came from the mainland, you know, because that's really mythological for a place that prides itself on having sagas that are based on real events. Like, that's really weird to have show up. But yeah, so this human guy turns into Fafnir the dragon, who hoards gold and is really greedy and loses it all because of his greed. Which is what we've talked about that.
We've talked about that at length. We've talked about the nature of greed and hoarding in The Hobbit. It also, by the way, I did just double check, just because I wanted to know, it was the Swedish translation which J.R.R. Tolkien considered absolutely awful. I don't think he actually did retranslate it, but he wrote scathing reviews.
Yeah.
And then...
Well, if he knew enough Swedish to say that it was a really bad translation, then...
just I found that very funny.
Yeah. But one of the things that I also find interesting, not just with the Volsunga saga, but with the sagas in general, is that they have so many female characters with agency, which is, again, something that Tolkien writes has quite a few of, you know, like Arwen makes her own decisions, and that decision is to marry Aragorn. And Eowyn is one of the examples that we used in the strong female characters episode. You know, she's such a cool lady. And those are the kinds of characters that appear in the Norse sagas.
Choice is an important part of all of Tolkien's characters, including his female characters.
Exactly.
And that makes it, even though there are some problems with Tolkien's characters, which, you know, we talked about in the Lord of the Rings stuff, we've talked previously about Tolkien and female characters.
Yes.
It's always really interesting because you always have that choice. If you didn't listen to the Lord of the Rings and Tolkien and Hobbit episodes previously, that's something that's come up.
Yes, definitely. And I love that about him. And I'm not going to say that he definitely took that from Norse sagas, because he probably didn't. Like, it's something that has come up in all types of literature across history, but it is something that appears in basically...
He was like, every character I base on my life is going to be the best character.
Yeah, and it's like it shows up in every Norse saga, which is something that I'm getting to, because there are so many Nazis in Norse and Viking Age stuff now, and I hate that. Why are they there?
As a big Tolkien fan, I feel you.
Why do they like the old Norse so much? Like, they're so completely different, you know, like... Iceland is the oldest democracy. Women had rights in Norse society. They could own property. They could vote.
As we talked about, I think probably, I can't remember if we talked about Tolkien, but certainly as usual, they have a certain view of these things, which is an inaccurate view, which they have then been like, this is the thing. I mean, the same is true about the people into the Roman Empire. A lot of people into military history as well, where they have very wrong ideas about what's important and how things happened and the lessons you can learn from these histories.
Yeah, it's like the average hair and eye colour in the Nordics is brown hair and brown eyes. And it always has been. Because that's the average, like, globally. You know, it's not all of Norse society was like snowy white with blonde hair and blue eyes. That's insane. That's an insane thing to believe about a society. Most of the Norse people were farmers or fishermen. They weren't all raiders. They weren't all, like, slavers.
The trade and cultural exchange in the Nordic era was far more important than the raiding to the economy, the culture, the power and strength of these nations. Like,
yeah. It's like,
as explorers and traders, you know, as a seafaring people, so much more important than anything else to their rise to preeminence in that time period.
Yeah. And it's like, it baffles me that there is this, there's such a sort of homogenous modern idea of the ancient Norse as all these big, strong, masculine men who fight everything that moves, and they wear stinky furs with helmets that look terrible. And I have no idea where it comes from, except I know exactly where it comes from. And it's fucking Wagner!
It's annoying to, I mean, like, it's annoying to, again, as you and me, both people that just love history in general, and I think have a great appreciation for the complexities of history, and, like, the various, like, oh, like, there's never, like, one thing doing this. Like, there's so much interlinkages and everything's all, like, interconnected. And then to have these people be, like, so dumb about the way they think these things work. Like, obviously not to be, like, oh, you need to have, like, a great understanding of academia or any of these things to understand this stuff. Because you really don't. Like, that's...
You don't!
This isn't, like, oh, you need to have, like, a strong academic understanding. No, you just need to know, like, the basic facts. The basic actual facts and not the weird fan fiction.
Yeah. Like, go and read a saga. It doesn't even need to be like one of the fancy academic translation versions with the footnotes or anything. You can read like a child's retelling of a saga. And there are so many like random people in them that are not the stereotype of a Viking that you are immediately like is immediately obvious that your assumptions are not true.
I'm seeing like but also just going on the general way in which the ancient world was and a few things I do know about Viking culture and stuff, I'm gonna bet there's a certain amount of emphasis on things like hospitality and truthfulness and things.
Women were really valued in Norse society because the women made fabric. So
the problem is people
genders had specific roles that they had to fulfill, and women were weaving cloth, and that was all they were allowed to do. But if you think about it, what are like the three things that you need to survive, right? You need shelter, you need food, you need water. The next thing you need is clothes. You know, and the women were weaving, right? That wasn't the only thing they did. But the person in your village who could weave the best...
The importance of fabric history, because obviously the other thing is, you know, we talk about weaving and fabric work and people think about clothing, which is obviously a big thing. But you've got to remember, there's loads of other things, including sails for ships that require that as well. It is obviously like a domestic job, but it's also just a general economy job.
It's like the person in the village who could make the best and strongest fabric was the richest person in the village.
Yeah, like it's
and that was almost always a woman. It's
way more important to the society and the culture and everything than metalwork. Metalwork's obviously still really important. I'm not, you know, dissing metalwork here, but the fabric work was way, way more influential.
Yeah. Definitely. And it's like the things that culturally we see now as women's work, things like embroidery and knitting and stuff like that, the men had to be able to do that too. Because if you were a raider and you were on a Viking ship and your sails got a hole in or your socks wore out, you had to be able to fix it.
And it's absolutely another thing, again, we have strayed far from the sagas here. But another thing that's really interesting is a lot of things of like, well, what is considered like the woman's work, like a lot of farming things are often seen as like, oh, like men did the farming stuff or women doing that. But in, say, vast areas of Scandinavia, where the men were out fishing during the entire farming season, women were the primary farm workers as well. They were the primary
definitely
workers. Like
when your men go off to fight, who is left to maintain the home?
And also another big thing, which societies throughout history have very often had, which is a big like push against a lot of the traditional views, because a lot of these things we're talking about, you can reshape to be somewhat like traddy, trad-wifey, like you know, and come up
with
the more complicated history isn't that better. But one of the big things that women have almost always been in charge of has been the accountancy and the management of businesses and the
oh my god,
funds and business and
the,
that.
The Norse were weird. They thought accountancy was witchcraft. The only people who were allowed to do maths were women.
Yeah, no, here's the thing. In loads and loads and loads of different time periods, including a lot of different medieval areas, accountancy and the running of like the household funds and figuring out of all of this stuff and control of funds, control of persons, a lot of this stuff could, again, depending on the culture and the time, it varied a lot, but would to varying degrees be the role of women. A thing which I think a lot of people forget. And one of the things I actually really enjoy in A Song of Ice and Fire, the Game of Thrones books, which people don't talk about enough, is the fact that women do learn accountancy in that. It is something that, like, again, Martin clearly knows that women were supposed to be in charge of. And Arya, the badass assassin woman, is one of the things she says she's better at than her sister is keeping accounts, which is like, I need more work about Arya to be like, yeah, obviously she's great at maths. Like, people forget this.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's like bringing it back to the sagas a little bit. My hot take, which is not so much as a hot take now, but specifically it would be a hot take in the Nazi circles. The Volsunga saga is not, as the Nazis would say, or some of the scholars would say, about the deeds of great men. The whole thing is actually about the women. It starts with women having, like, the women starting the family. You know, the women having, I think it was the ring that one of the women had first, or a sword or something. It's always the women giving things to the men. There are 5 chapters in a row in the Volsunga saga about the women, or the things that the women persuaded the men to do, or the things that the women gifted to the men. The men wouldn't be able to do shit without the women there. You know, they'd be helpless. But that's not something that's like unique to that saga either. Like, the last sort of segment of the Vinland sagas is about Freydis, Leif Erikson's sister, sailing to Vinland on her own voyage. So there's Leif Erikson, and then I can't remember his name, Thorvald, who's his brother, and Freydis, the sister. And the middle guy died. The middle guy died in Vinland. He got into conflict with the natives and was killed. And Freydis organized her own expedition with her own ships that were not given to her by Leif Erikson. She got her own, and she sailed to Vinland to bring her brother's body home. And she was in charge of that. Her husband went with her, but she was in charge of it.
And this again, if you study history, almost basically anything more than the skin deep history that you might have heard like in school and stuff, and school is getting better at this nowadays, but like,
yeah,
seriously, if you study history more, you realize how not remarkable this is. Like, how much this is just how it's literally always been, because of course women have always been doing things and always viewed as like important people capable of doing stuff, because they are. Like,
yeah.
It's absolutely ridiculous for society. And obviously, you know, there has been sexism and problems with sexism about the way in which women could access certain stuff. But despite that, in spite of those restrictions and things, people have always had women doing stuff because it's simply obvious that they should.
Yeah. And it's like, it's absolutely tragic that people don't know about all of this. Just like, it's not like the sagas specifically, but like, they don't know about the important things that women have done in history. I find that completely tragic. It's like when you think
time period or a single specific, like just looking at the dude bro timelines of things like Vikings, we've talked about Romans, Roman women, incredibly important and incredibly influential. Sparta, Spartan women, incredibly important and influential. Often more so than the kings. Like, there is not a period of history, even the most stereotypically masculine and militaristic and all of those things, which does not have incredibly important women doing incredibly important, fundamental, basic stuff that you need for that society to function at all, and involving themselves in every level of that society, including in the military stuff. Like, there is absolutely loads of women who have absolutely been involved in military history. Like yeah. It's not all like Joan of Arc and stuff. Like, women have been, anytime you read anything about like any war at all, just add in, like, just remember there will have been a bunch of women involved in that yeah. plenty of times.
Yeah, and it's like, if you want to think about it just on a very like basic level, the societies that have like a pantheon in their religion, like the Greeks, the Romans, the Norse, the like Hindu religions, mm-hmm. the religions that have like many, many deities always have at least some of them are women.
Yeah, and indeed.
They're worshipping them!
And also, I think the thing is, because a lot of those women sometimes don't have cool stories about them, or also because of the cultural changes and stuff,
what do you consider a cool story?
We forget how important, you know, those goddesses were, because things like Hera, you know, is the god of marriage and family. Like, we forget how important that concept was historically, and how important and, like, fundamental Hera was to this stuff, and how much, like, no, the likes of Hera, or even something, you know, like Aphrodite with love. But of course, there's plenty of other goddesses who don't even fit that mold. Because, you know, Hera, Hestia with the hearth, you know, these are goddesses who we don't necessarily fully understand the exact role of in today's society, because things have, you know, those concepts have sort of shifted around a bit and don't seem as important to us, but were super, super important at the time. But also, plenty of goddesses like Freya in Norse mythology, Athena as a goddess of wisdom and war and crafts, like super, super important stuff. Isis in Egyptian mythology, who is one of the most powerful of all the gods. Like, again and again and again, female figures and female roles are just incredibly important to the culture, to the religion, to the society, to everything, because of course they are.
It's like coming back to the like Norse sagas, the Icelandic sagas specifically, the Landnemabók, which is about the like founding of Iceland, talks about someone called Una Ketilsdóttir, who was one of the founders of Iceland. She was a woman who used to be a slave. Like, what? Like, that, reading it as like someone like from modern days where we've had all the like the sexism and the stuff about like how some people are just less than other people. In modern society, she would never have gotten to that point. She's like one of the most important figures in Icelandic history because she helped found the country. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if you think about like in America, when they talk about the founding fathers who play the same role, all of them were men. All of them had wives.
Yeah, and like very occasionally a couple of them get some reference.
John Adams' wife has been getting some recognition for the letters that she sent him, trying to encourage him to vote certain ways on certain things. But
that time where one of the presidents had a stroke and was very much not capable of being president, but they didn't. They basically didn't tell anyone, and his wife basically had to do all the work.
Oh my god! Yeah,
it's absolutely crazy how important a role like women have literally always played throughout every society at all points in history in various different ways with different levels of discrimination and stuff, but also very importantly different discriminations. Like, there has never, because gender essentialism is bullshit, there has never been a single set up this is the way in which women are lesser than us and can't do these things. That has simply never been the way in which human society in general has always been. No. What women can do and what roles they play has always varied and had different judgments and things, and what role men have been able to play. You know, men have absolutely experienced that at times where they've been like, no, you are barred from this grouping because it is a woman's grouping and you shouldn't be involved in it because you're a man. And what that is has also massively changed at various different times.
Definitely, yeah. And it's just like, yeah, it gets to me. But almost all of the female characters in the Icelandic sagas and the Norse sagas generally, they have something going for them that isn't just falling at the feet of like the first strong manly man that they can find and being their wives and having their children. Not that that's not an important role to have, but like they can do their own things, you know. Mm-hmm. They can manipulate the plot in their own ways. They can do important things and be important to society because they're people. And I think that's pretty cool. You don't see that as much in like English literature because we are
those things that
really very culturally sexist.
It's one of those things that really does vary, because again, if you look at some of these things, if you look at some of the like early Arthurian legends, like some of the Welsh and Irish and Scottish mythology, you absolutely can find that again. But there's a certain time period, and I don't want to blame it on the Victorians. A lot of
it's colonialism.
A lot of it is the Victorian fault. Some of it
it's colonialism's fault.
Well, some of it is colonialism, but some of these are like English stories as well. But there has certainly been, basically, in certain times, there was more of a push of what women can do that has sort of stayed around. And I think, obviously, Victorian women also were doing stuff and were involved in lots of things. But I think Victorian attitudes about women are ones that have had more staying power in comparison to, say, Carolingian views about women or Elizabethan views about women. You know, I think the Victorian ones have had a bit more staying power in terms of some of those expectations. And I think that's for a variety of reasons, partly colonialism and the desire to really spread those views. You know, it doesn't matter so much what English women are doing but it does matter because you need to have the display of what women are like, because you don't want to have women in colonized countries doing things and being important. So like there's a lot of different reasons for it, and it's not all Victorian. That is an oversimplification massively. A lot of it's also modern sexism and modern ideas of sexism. You look at various things, but like there was definitely a point, and I think Victorian is sort of the start of it, whereby women were being shifted out of the new industries because suddenly you could have such a high level of production without the entire population working, that this idea of women as like things that didn't do stuff, you know, things that didn't do stuff rather than people, became more of a more established as sort of culture. But that's a whole, talking about how sexism has developed over the years and how we got to where we are currently with sexism is a whole other episode, and we should absolutely not go into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because that's like a lot.
You
and it's also not something that we like. Sexism is not something that we like, and therefore we cannot talk about it. To be fair, though, we talked a lot about William Morris today, and he's not someone that I like either.
Yes, we like discussions of sexism that get to the roots of like how we got here and what we can do now to better our society and reach a better position for everyone.
Definitely.
Ways in which sexism negatively affects us all. Like again, it's one of the things I always like to remind people about all kinds of discrimination is not just evil, which is enough, it's also stupid. Like
it
we
is
lose out on things. Like there are so many cool things that women have given us and that we could get from having women more involved in stuff, just on like a basic level of like, hey, female like scientists and doctors and stuff who would have been great but were consigned, you know, to be in different roles in history, and so we lost out on that and could have been much more progressed just on that, you know, we're screwed. But also just this idea of like, oh, we can't go see like the chick flick or whatever, and it's like, no, you absolutely can. Like
you can,
men, like fully cis het men, like feel free to experience femininity more, like
definitely. But anyway, we did get to the end of my notes because I can't really remember all that much about what happens in basically any of the actual sagas. I should have talked about the Vinland sagas because I read that more recently, but I did not want to. I had less academic sources I could use for that. But, yeah. So, I'm trying to think if there's anything else I can say. There are many different translations of many different sagas. You should try and read some of them. Because they are good. And, like, the whole point is that the language is relatively simple and easy to read. So if you're reading one and you're like, this is difficult, I'm not really understanding it, you're reading a bad translation, find a better one, basically, is what you should be getting from this.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, so I guess that is sort of everything. I did tell you it was going to be quite short.
That is everything and a variety of different side quests.
Yeah, we said it was going to be about Norse sagas. It's kind of not really. But I think it's interesting anyway. I find it interesting. I liked reading about it when I was researching it. It drove me insane. Like, you should have seen some of the messages I was sending people at the time. It was mental. People were telling me to calm down because I was just, like, so infuriated by the stuff I was finding out. Like, when I found out that other scholars at the time had been asking William Morris for sources and he just never replied, I was just like, well, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, but yeah, so it's been fun. I hope you have had as much fun.
Yes, no, well, it's always interesting, so thank you very much. And
but yeah, so I don't know what the next episode will be, but it will be up in 2 weeks. Yeah, so I guess thank you everybody for listening. We will be back next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye, everyone.
Goodbye.
Thank you so much for listening. If you've made it all the way to the end, congrats! You're officially much stronger than half of our friends. If you're enjoying listening to this podcast, please subscribe so you get notified when we update, or sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/hey_i_like, where you have a direct line to us, the creators. You can also follow us on Tumblr at heyilike, which is all lowercase. That's all for now. See you next time on Hey, I Like.